All right, everybody, stop enjoying your relationships with each other. We're in Daniel chapter 1. So we're going to be doing Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 through 21, the whole chapter today. And so we introduced the book of Daniel last week, and I'm really excited to go through this. There's going to be a lot of fun lessons in this for us, a lot of things that are very applicable for kind of the state of the nation right now and the context in which Daniel was writing, and there'll be a lot of parallels in that way. If there's anybody that needs any material, Mike Bunn can hand it out if anybody needs it. Okay, Scott Rasmussen is going to open us up in a word of prayer. All right. Here's the outline chart for Daniel that we are looking at for these studies. I want to just point something out because it'll pertain especially to chapter 1. Chapter 1 is written in Hebrew. Chapters 2 through 7 is written in Aramaic. And then again, 8 through 12 is written in Hebrew. Of those two languages, which is the language of the Jewish nation? Hebrew is. What is the language of the Babylonians then? Aramaic is. That was like the lingua franca of the day for the Babylonians. That means it was the most common language of the day, just like Greek was in the New Testament time period. And so when you're reading Daniel, which chapters do you think would have special application for the Jews? The Hebrew ones, right? Which chapters would have special application and meaning to the Babylonians? Yeah, 2 through 7 would. Now, all of it would have application to both groups ultimately, but there's very special points to be made from a Jewish perspective in chapter 1, from a Babylonian perspective in 2 through 7, and then again from a Jewish perspective in 8 through 12. And that's maybe one of the reasons why we have the couple different languages going on in the book. So in chapter 1, it can be broken up with three different sections. Verses 1 through 7, you have the exile, and Nebuchadnezzar is trying to brainwash the people while they're in exile. That section begins by saying that the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. The next section, in verses 8 through 16, shows Daniel standing firm in exile when he refuses to eat the food. And that section also begins by saying that God gave Daniel favor. And then the third section, verses 17 through 21, Daniel's rewarded in exile for his faithfulness. And that section also begins by saying God gave. So there's three times that this chapter repeats the idea that God is the one giving. God is the one in control, even though the Babylonians seem to have conquered the Israelites. And that's going to be the theme of the whole book. That's the theme of this chapter. Any comments or questions about that? All right, let's go ahead and look at this section by section, and we'll talk about the first seven verses, but I'm going to break this up into two sections. Let's look at verses 1 and 2 first. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and place the vessels in the treasury of his God. All right, if you were to just be looking at these two verses, verse 1 seems to record what happens from a secular mindset or a secular perspective. Is this giving you the history? And the history is that Jehoiakim was taken, Nebuchadnezzar besieged him in his third year, but then in verse 2 we get the God perspective of what happened. What's happening from the earthly versus the God perspective? Yeah, Peggy? Yep, God is the one that's in control. And does this ever get to the head of Nebuchadnezzar? The fact that this victory happened? Go over to chapter 4, verse 30. This is when his pride basically turns him into an animal, and that's what pride does with anybody. But in Daniel chapter 4, verse 30, it says, "And the king answered and said, 'Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence for the glory of my majesty?'" So this is when he's walking around saying, look at all the great things that I've done. And then he, boom, he gets turned into like an animal. But when he has this victory, this gets to his head amongst all the other victories he would have had in history. Peggy? Yep, good. Yeah, Scott? Right. Yep. Good. All right. What year of Jehoiakim's reign did this happen? Third year. Now, I don't know if any of you are aware of the alleged contradiction. Jeremiah 25:1, and then also in verse 9, says, "The word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the people of Judah in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, behold, I will send for all the tribes of the north, declares the Lord, and for Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and I will bring them against this land." So Daniel says that it happens in Jehoiakim's third year. Jeremiah says that it happens in the fourth year. Does anybody know how to resolve that tension? Yeah. Okay, so it's possible Jeremiah's rounding up to 4 years and Daniel's rounding down. That's one possibility. Does anybody have any other thoughts on that? Yeah, Peggy? Okay, any other thoughts? Scott? Right. So, well, in Jeremiah, this is talking about Nebuchadnezzar's first year and Jehoiakim's fourth year. And when you get to verse 9, this is talking about the same judgment that we see in Daniel. Yeah. No. Okay. Barb is right on this then. The Jewish people used a different dating system for a king's reign than the Babylonians did. So for example, the Babylonians had something called an accession year, which was their first year as on the throne, and they would typically co-reign with the previous king. And it was almost like a training year in a sense, where they wouldn't really count the first year. So the Jewish people counted the first year. So what's going on is Jeremiah uses Jewish dating. He's writing from Judea, from Jerusalem, and he's using their dating method. Daniel is writing from Babylon, and he's using the Babylonian dating method. So there's no contradiction. This is, again, one of those things that skeptics would bring up and say, look, we can't trust the Bible because of X, Y, or Z. And when you dig into these kinds of things, you actually see that the Bible's much more trustworthy than you even ever thought before that. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah. Okay, this isn't an issue of rounding up or down, though. This is a difference in the kind of counting that the two nations would use. Yeah, okay. All right, something else that happens in the first two verses is Nebuchadnezzar comes and he takes the vessels. Does anybody know where these vessels, like all these cups and everything that were from the temple, does anybody know where else they show up in Daniel? Yeah, so in Daniel chapter 5, Belshazzar, he's one of the other kings that we read about in this book, he has this giant party, and they're all drinking wine from those things, and that's when we get the handwriting on the wall, the many, many tekel parson things. So that's in the context of them using those very vessels for those purposes at that party. And eventually the vessels return in Ezra chapter 1, 7 through 11. It talks about all the vessels coming back to God's house and everything like that. All right, anything else you guys want to add to the first two verses? All right, let's look at verses 3 through 7 and then see the actual brainwashing that the king tries to do on the people. So verse 3, then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate, and of the wine that he drank, they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king. Among those were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah of the tribe of Judah, and the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. All right, can you guys think of any reasons why the Babylonians would want to take the cream of the crop and retrain them? Okay, why would that be a good tactic, though? Scott? So, can you say that in another way? Yeah, so they want to retrain these people, and Mark? Right. And if you can get the cream of the crop of Judea retrained to start thinking the way that the Babylonians thought, what a good way for them to become ambassadors to their fellow Judeans and to change them. So here, the way that Nebuchadnezzar is trying to get into these young people, in verse 4 they're called youths, which could mean they're 14 to 17 years old. That's probably a good estimation of the age that Daniel was. So he's trying to get them to learn all of these things that the Chaldeans would teach. He's trying to get them to learn the language, but he's taking the best of the best, the most influential people, to try to influence not only them, but also the rest of the Judeans, most likely. Peggy, were you going to say something? Yeah. And how long was the training going to be?
Well, think of it, if you give them 3 years here, the training started, and then if they hit the road, they're going to battle.
Right. The official training was 3 years. Jesus trained his disciples for three and a half years. But this kind of sounds like college in some ways, doesn't it? Like you get isolated from your family. And I'm not against going to college. I went to college, so don't misunderstand anything I'm about to say. But like they try to isolate the people from their families, and then they try to indoctrinate them with false ideas. But notice what happens here. Look at the names in verse 7. So all the names get changed, and there's some debate about the meanings of the names of the Chaldean names. But Daniel's name means God is my judge. Hananiah's name means the Lord has been gracious. Mishael's name means who is like God. And Azariah's name means the Lord is my help. So all of these guys' names have God in it. Any names that have E-L in it, or Aya, A-I-A-H, has some kind of God thing in it. Okay? So all of these names get changed. Daniel's name gets changed to Belteshazzar. That means Bel. Bel is their false god, one of their false gods. Bel protect him. Some people say it means Bel protect the king. So you're calling on a false god's protection. Ananias' name to Shadrach means the command of Aku. It's one of the false gods. Meshach means who is like Aku. So Mishael, who is like God, is changed to who is like Aku. And then Azariah is Abednego. That means servant of Nebo, which is another false god. I'll leave that up there if you guys want to write any of that down. I think that's interesting, though. Yeah, Mark and then Jim. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and you try, like, why would they be trying to change their names and then have them learn? They're trying to strip God away from them. By the way, is this not what happens on some college settings? Like, this is just like college right here. Like, we're gonna call you by a different name, we're gonna retrain you, we're gonna make you think differently about everything. Now, Daniel's not going to be influenced by this stuff. And there's going to be an interesting contrast in the next section between what he's willing to fight for and what he's willing to not fight for. Peggy? Right. Yeah, we'll look at that when he stands firm in just a moment. I thought I saw some other hands about this section. Jim, are you going to say something?
I'm just going to say something a little trivia, that Aku is a moon god.
Okay, Aku is a moon god. I did not know that. So, who is like the moon god? Who, Aku gives commands, all of that kind of thing. So, worship the moon. There you go. Don't do that. By the way, this also shows you that they had multiple gods. You have Bel. You have Aku, you have Nebo. They believed in many different gods, just like our culture has many different gods. So, all right, anything else you guys want to say about that? Virginia? Yep. I think they all got eunuchized, if that can be a verb, because we looked at that in Isaiah 39. The prophecy to King Hezekiah was going to be that his children would be brought into Babylon and they'd be turned into eunuchs. And you see a eunuch here, right, in verse 3. Ashpenaz is the chief eunuch, and it's like he's dealing with these people from Babylon, or from Israel, and it seems like they've kind of created their own like eunuch group of people, and he's like helping them learn how to be eunuchs or something. So I think so. That's my guess though. Yeah, Mark. Right, and this is another interesting thing to say about this is Daniel is from a really important family. People that were from important families in that time period probably had a lot of association with the temple. Once he's turned into a eunuch, can he go to the temple? No. So it might be another way of saying, look, this is your home now, buddy. You're going to stay here. You're the cream of the crop, and we want you here. There's a lot of interesting things to say about all of that. All right, anything else you guys want to say about the name changes? So you see, Satan's tactic for trying to get people to conform to the world is to teach them their teachings and then to call you by something different. Okay? All right, so with that in mind then, look at how Daniel stands firm and look at verses 8 to 16. It says, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear the Lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. Alright, main thing that's happening right here is Daniel's refusing to do what? Defile himself with the king's food and wine. Now here's a question. Why have a food fight but not fight over the name change? So Daniel, in other words, when it comes to having his name changed, we don't read about him throwing up his arms about that one. In fact, he's going to be called Belteshazzar later on in the book. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are going to go by those names later on in the book. But when it comes to the defiling food, that's when Daniel resolves, I'm not going to do this. So why fight over the food but not the name? Virginia? Okay, so there's some debate about what was wrong with the food. Some people say that it was unclean meat. It was pork, it was horse, it was seafood, it was all those kinds of things. It's possible that it was unclean food. I think it's likely that it was. Something else to say about it is, was the food offered to idols? Exodus 34 talks about not having food that was offered to idols. And so it's probably actually a combination of both of those things, though I can't prove that definitively. Either way, there's something about the food that would defile Daniel. Yeah, Mark? Okay, good. So the Babylonians can call him whatever they want to call him. Daniel knows who he is. So you can call me whatever you want, but I know my identity. And so the fact that you're changing my name, whatever, but when it comes to eating the food, that will defile me, because that's an action I would partake in. Yeah, it is. Yep, Barb. And I think this is one of the most important decisions that Daniel makes in the book. This decision is what's going to basically commission him as a prophet of God. And because he makes this decision right here, I'm not going to eat from the food. I'm not going to eat the king's food. Like the rest of the book, he sets the tone right at the beginning. As a youth, keep in mind, 14 to 17 years old, he resolves, he makes the decision before he even knows the consequences, I'm going to do whatever God tells me to do. And because of that, he influenced a lot of people in Babylon. The Magi that came from the east in Matthew chapter 2, east was Babylon. Where would they have ever heard about this coming one that would enlighten people? From Daniel. So there's a lot of interesting things about that. Let's talk a little bit more, though, about why have the food fight but not fight over the name change. Kathy?
Well, I was looking at it as the name change didn't bother his conscience. Mm-hmm. Because, like you said, God knew what, and so he didn't care. And so he
Yeah.
And that's where the stand.
That's where you got to stand firm, is when the government's asking you to do something sinful, that's where you say no. This shows us, though, an interesting principle about how Christians should interact with culture. Are there some things that culture or people around us would want us to do, or maybe the government would tell us to do, that we wouldn't prefer, but it doesn't cause us to sin? And in those cases, should we not throw a hissy fit about it? Let's say, for example, that the government decides to start taxing churches. Would that be sinful? That wouldn't be sinful. Would a lot of Christians throw up their arms over it and get really mad about it? Yes. Okay, think about Daniel. You gotta pick your fights. When the government's telling you something that's sinful to do, that's where you put your foot down. When the government's telling you something that's not preferable, but it's not sinful, pick your fights carefully. Any comments or questions about that? Can you guys think of any other examples of that? Where Christians might sometimes throw up their arms and get into a fight about things that's not causing them to sin, but maybe we overreact to some of those kinds of things when we shouldn't? Politics? I think that's a big one. What else? Scott? Right. How many people who at least claim to be Christians get all up in arms when the Ten Commandments get taken out of some building or something like that? We're not even under the Ten Commandments, so whatever. Kathy?
Abortion,
like that's where we should put the foot down, you mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. All right, anything else? I think it's important to think through that concept and be wise with how we interact with culture. All right. I thought I was going to say something else about that, but I don't remember now. All right, what do you guys think about what happens with Daniel here? So he, in verse 8, he resolves that he's not going to defile himself, but he initially goes to Ashpenaz, and he asks to not defile himself with the food. What's the first response that he gets? Yeah, he's like, hey man, I'm gonna die. Like I gotta take care of you guys, and if you're not eating this kind of meat, you're not gonna be as fat and all this kind of stuff. And so, what does Daniel do then? Yeah, he goes to another servant who's over him, and he says, hey, just give us 10 days. Let's just eat the vegetables and see if we're not fatter in flesh. Now, when it says fatter in flesh, what do you think that means? Yeah, stronger is the idea. Although there are some secular writings from the Babylonian time period about people that were in positions of teaching, and like Buddha was pretty fat, right? Like that's how he's pictured, and he was from Babylon. There was something about teachers being like literally fat, where that was like looked up upon by some people. So it could be that it says being stronger. It could be that it's that they were actually a little bit fatter. I don't know which way to take that, but I think stronger is probably the concept that's in mind there. But initially he gets rejected, and Daniel doesn't go, well, you know, we're not in Jerusalem anymore. It's not really a big deal. Like nobody will even know. It's just us four main guys right here. Like he doesn't compromise at all. And he says, all right, please test us for 10 days and then see what happens. Now, when it says that they are going to eat vegetables, let me say this first about Daniel. Daniel's been misused by some people to push certain kinds of diet. Does anybody know where wheatgrass came from, the idea for wheatgrass? You know where people juice wheatgrass and then they drink the wheatgrass? It comes from Daniel, chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar's made into like an animal and he's eating the grass. Some person was like, oh, wheatgrass, let's juice grass. It'll be like Nebuchadnezzar. But other people have looked at Daniel chapter 1 and said, well, Christians should just eat vegetables. And that's why he's healthier. Is that the point of this text? Why not? Yeah, Mark? Yeah.
I know God's going to take care of it. Even if I eat just vegetables, I should look worse, but I'm going to look better.
Yeah. And did God ever command that the Israelites eat meat? For the sacrifices. This is not like there's a book that was recently written called The Daniel Plan, and it's about Daniel's, like, physical health and how we need to be physically healthy Christians like Daniel was because he ate vegetables and he cared about what he was eating. That's not the point of this. It's saying that he's refusing to do what the Babylonians did and defile himself, and God is the one that's helping them. At this point, was Daniel already a handsome guy? Was he already smart? So the vegetables is not what caused him to have more of that. He already had it. So he would have already been eating meat in Babylon. That's not the point of this. Virginia? All right, something else to notice here. Daniel's courtesy towards the Babylonians. Do you guys see any things that he does here that shows that he's being courteous or kind to the Babylonians here? Yeah, he says, please. And, like, when people are trying to push him to do something wrong, he doesn't go, I'm going to stand up for my rights because I'm an American. I'm sorry. He's like, hey, please. Like, I'm going to be courteous here. I'm not going to be all about my rights. I'm going to push what I think is the right thing, but I'm going to do it in a courteous kind of way. And that, again, connects to 1 Peter, where Peter tells the audience to honor everybody. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah.
Well, I think the request, it seems kind of outrageous. I mean, you would tell the king, absolutely, I'm not going to eat your food. It's an insult. And he has the power to just kill him right on the spot.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you guys have ever had somebody over at your house and somebody's like, no, I'm not going to have any of your food. It's like, you take that kind of personally, right? Like, here's the king saying, like, hey, come on over and have some of my food. And Daniel's going, nope, I'm not going to, because this would cause me to be defiled. And so the way that Daniel handles this, like Ben was saying, he's got to be very courteous with this because this is a very delicate situation. Yeah, Jim? Yeah. Yeah. Good. Peggy? Yeah, that would be a hard thing. If somebody's telling you to do something that's wrong, my temptation would be to start chucking spears at somebody, metaphorically, with my words. Daniel here, even as a youth, he's going through puberty, like he's got all these emotions going on, like, well, he was this eunuch, guys, never mind, sorry. He was made into a eunuch, sorry. I shouldn't have said any of that. but like, he here is able to deal very kindly with these leaders. So, were you going to say something, Peggy? Yeah. And this shows you how to stand up for truth in a truthful kind of way. There's some people that will fight over truth, but doing it in a dogmatic and ungodly, unloving kind of way. And here you've got Daniel standing up for the truth. He's combining, like Ephesians 4:15 says, speak the truth in love. And people tend to just focus on love and not truth. And then other people focus on truth but not love. And here's Daniel doing both of them. So, all right, let's see what the result of this. Let's see how he's rewarded. Look at verses 17 to 21. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom, and Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Alright, so during these 3 years, Nebuchadnezzar would be thinking, I am giving Daniel all of this wisdom. The text says that God is the one that's giving it to him. So the great learning that Daniel's getting is not really from the Babylonians, it's from God. But what does he learn here? Interpret dreams. He knows all the literature and wisdom. Does that mean that he's learning secular stuff? Is it wrong for a Christian to study Socrates or Plato? No. Would that actually get your foot in the door with some people if you can talk about those things but then show where it's wrong and show it connected to the Bible and everything like that? Yeah. So like the way that I picture Daniel is he's like the college professor today who's highly educated but is also a Christian and knows all of that kind of stuff but can get his foot in the door and really influence some people that our culture would view as the highly educated. That's the kind of sphere of influence that he has. Yeah, Gary? Yep. Yeah, in Acts and in Titus, Paul quotes Greek poets. There's something to be said about knowing what the culture believes and then showing, okay, that's not right because of X, Y, or Z, and like actually being able to reason it out. Now, notice though, during these 3 years, I think this is when Daniel basically gets commissioned as a prophet because that's when he gets understanding in visions and dreams. So think about the major prophets and their commissions. For Daniel here, there's something that happens with all of their mouths. Daniel, he refuses to eat defiling food and then he's made into a prophet. Isaiah, in that vision that he has, a coal touches his mouth and then he starts preaching with his now cleansed mouth. Jeremiah, God touches his mouth in Jeremiah chapter 1. And then in Ezekiel, Ezekiel is told to eat the scroll. So for all four of the major prophets, you've got something happening with their mouth, and then they're going to use their mouth to speak God's words. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah, Virginia? It doesn't seem like it to the extent that, yeah, it seems like Daniel's kind of the head of the four people. Yeah, I think they were given understanding in literature, but then in verse 17 it says, and Daniel specifically had understanding in all visions and dreams. So I think they were all very wise, but Daniel had the ability to interpret visions and dreams and things like that. So, all right, that's a good question. All right. So the king has these people come before him, and how many times better are these people than the others? 10 times. In the Hebrew, that actually means 10 hands better. Which, like, 10 hands is occupied by how many people? 5, right? So, like, one of these guys was better than 5 of the Babylonians is the idea. And so they were tested for 10 days with the vegetables, and they're found 10 times better than all the other magicians and all that kind of thing. But look at verse 21. Daniel's success causes him to outlive the Babylonians because it says in verse 21, Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Anybody know what year King Cyrus takes over the nation? Yeah, 539, 536, somewhere in that time period. Probably more like 539. Persia takes over, and so here you've got Daniel outliving his captors because God is rewarding him for his faithfulness. Peggy? Right. 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 Which is, his influence would have been better suited to stay in Babylon. Right. Right, good. Any other comments or questions about that? The last time marker in Daniel is in chapter 10, verse 1. Daniel 10, 1 says, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So that would be around 536 B.C. So, and Daniel was exiled around 605 B.C. So this is about 71 years or so where Daniel's in exile. And so at the end of the book, let's say he was 15 at the beginning of the book. At the end of the book, how old is he? 85, 86. So and he's faithful his whole life, but it starts in his youth when he resolves to not eat the food of the king. All right. Anything else you guys want to say about any of that?
Mm-hmm. And Daniel was keeping the law, so there was a remnant.
Yep. Yeah, and Jeremiah 25 would actually indicate that the faithful people were the ones who were exiled, and the unfaithful ones were the ones who stayed there for further judgment. So, yeah, Scott?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, before any of these prophets started prophesying, I think Isaiah 6 is out of chronological order. Isaiah 6 is when he's actually commissioned, but you have the first five chapters of Isaiah depicting the state of the nation, and then boom, here's your prophet. But all of them had to have something done to their mouth before they start speaking. And it's interesting, with Ezekiel, he has to eat the right thing before he can speak the right thing. There's some people that want to speak about God, but they haven't eaten his words first. You've got to get it in you before you get the right things out of you. Peggy? Yeah, good. Something else then, you guys can write this down if you want. Isaiah chapter 3, verses 1 through 7-ish, talks about how God is going to be taking away from Jerusalem the mighty men, the judge, the diviner, the elder, like all of the really smart people in the city. And the result of that is going to be that the nation's going to want like children to rule for them. When we get into these prophets, a lot of these prophets kind of can be synthesized together because Isaiah is talking about similar events that Daniel's recording. So Isaiah 3, 1 through 7 is a good cross-reference for what we just looked at. All right, we're out of time, so we'll look at Daniel chapter 2 next week.